The Tom Woods Show, episode 2324.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, believing that the end of the world might be a bad thing that we should try to avoid is not a Russian talking point. But if we are going to avoid World War III, it's important for Americans to understand what's been left out of the CIA's narrative about Russia and Ukraine. Coming to the rescue here is my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Ukraine. Pick it up at wrongaboutukraine.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. It's been quite a while since I've spoken to Steve Patterson. Steve, we must have talked about your Bitcoin book maybe the last time you were here. I don't even remember.
Yeah, I think it was. Actually, we did a little philosophical discussion, and I think the one before that was a Bitcoin book.
Oh, you're right. You're right. So you've been kind of an independent, I don't even know, do you want to use the word scholar, or do you feel like that's been, there are too many
painted, yeah,
shysters who use that word?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually was given a talk several years ago, and somebody introduced me as an academic, and I was like, listen, that is a four-letter word.
Yeah, I would not use academic. That's
no.
True.
So I'm just an independent researcher. I'm probably going to qualify as mostly a philosopher. That's the stuff I've gotten interested in mainly over the years. But my work and my interests cover a big range of topics. So politics, economics, and then a bunch of different areas in philosophy, philosophy of mind, philosophy of math. So yeah, I just decided to do my own independent research several years ago and did some traveling around interviewing people on with my podcast called Patterson in Pursuit. And now I actually just finished ghostwriting a book, a second book on Bitcoin. So finished that up. And then I'm hoping to start my own little research institute here coming up later this year to try to be able to do more professional research. A lot of people are complaining that academia is broken and the world of ideas has taken over. That's correct. But we got to do something about it. We got to start creating alternative institutions and populate them with alternative researchers. So that's what I'm trying to do.
I want to make a confession to you right here on the program. When you were at the Foundation for Economic Education for a brief time, isn't that right?
Yep.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of went out on your own and you just described that. And your explorations took you intellectually really all over the place, all kinds of different topics, all different areas of study. And what you kept finding was, I mean, you were quite Socratic about it in that Socrates went around asking judges, what is the meaning of justice? And they, none of them could give an answer. So what you found was that very often the foundations of the disciplines you were looking at were actually much shakier than anybody realized, because most people, let's be honest, they enter a discipline, they read what's in the textbook, they master the textbook, they write an article or two, and then they go teach what was in that textbook.
Right.
But they're invested in what's in that textbook because it's holding up their whole discipline. But if you're somebody like Steve Patterson, who has no dog in this particular hunt, you can actually slay some sacred cows here. And so you were going into, let's say, mathematics, and you were asking, I wonder, does such and such as this or that concept really make sense? And so the confession I want to make to you, Steve, and I'm sorry and ashamed to do it, but I think in the interest of honesty, I should do it. At the time, I thought, oh, Steve has just gone too far. You know, it's one thing to be, what's the word? Not a maverick. What did they say, Socrates? Why, gadfly, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to do that. But, you know, you have to know your limits. Nobody can be an expert on everything. And to just go in, I was wrong. I was completely wrong about this. And it has helped that over the past few years, watching public health collapse before my eyes made me think, oh my gosh, to think I ever thought letters after your name necessarily meant something and that the longevity of a belief necessarily meant something. I'm ashamed I believed that, and I appreciate your fearlessness in just going in there, shining the light of reason in one area after another, and just letting the chips fall where they may. So there you have it, Steve.
Well, thank you, Tom. That's very nice of you to say. And I had a conversation that started similar to this with Bob Murphy, because he was playfully ribbing me for years about some of my claims about specifically the philosophy of mathematics. I won't go into them here, but I was shocked and horrified to discover that there are a bunch of foundational dogmas in modern mathematics, at least in the past century or so, which turn out to be wrong or very poorly founded. My mind was blown when I discovered this. Anyway, Bob said, like you know, Steve, you're pushing it a little bit too far here. Like, this is, come on, math, are you kidding? Of all places, this is the most rigorous. And we spoke, I don't know, maybe a year ago or so. And I think I persuaded him specifically on some of the math stuff now. So we're starting, the enlightenment has now beginning where people have lost total faith that the academics, especially of the last century, were frankly competent, or that, like you said, that the letters after the name meant something. I've taken to this, I'm going to call myself the dark age guy. So I've taken this and said, okay, I've tried to wrap my head around the state that we're in post-COVID. A lot of people's eyes are opening. And then some of the crazier stuff in mathematics that I've discovered, the foundations of physics in the first part of the 20th century. And my conclusion is we've been living in a dark age. Essentially, I put the founding of the dark age somewhere from like 1880 to 1950. I make some arguments for that. So one of the main areas that I want to research with my research institute is specifically examining this question of just how many ideas, paradigmatic ideas, do we have that we are assuming to be true that are false. If it's in math, it's in physics, it's in economics, as you well know, it's in our political theories. Where isn't it? And if these ideas are so terrible, somebody's got to do the work to figure out what ideas exactly are bad and try to fix them as best we can. So I'm trying to do that, and happy to say, so far seem to be making progress as well. And at this point, like, I used to sort of lean into the crackpot image just because I think it's funny. So it's like, oh yeah, I have very ridiculous ways of phrasing some of my more controversial beliefs. Like, I don't think circles exist, which is like a really funny and provocative way to say something about the philosophy of mathematics. But just in the past few years, I sort of have given up that game a little bit because I'm like, you know, I figured out enough. I'm not actually alone in my heresy. It turns out, finally, after years of research, there are established dissident traditions in literally every domain that I'm researching. So in math, there are the finitists. It's a traditional school going back, you know, many years. You know, in economics, of course, there are the Austrians that are the dissidents. And pretty much everywhere you look, there are going to be dissident schools that have managed to preserve their rationality in very dark times. So I can't pretend to be as much of a renegade crackpot as I could have a few years ago.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it means your sympathies are with the renegade crackpots. And that's more than most people can say. Or at least you want to investigate what they're saying.
Yeah.
Because we know what the incentive structure is like in academia and in American society. It's just go with the flow. Do not be a dissident. Even though everybody gets that commencement day speech, be your own person, you know, do your own thing. They don't mean that.
No,
that is
no.
The last thing in the world they want you to do.
Yes.
Instead, we want you to conform. And it's not that all the Keynesians in the world are part of a grand conspiracy. It's that most people, you know, I'm going to sound like an elitist here, but most people are just time-serving drones.
Yeah.
They clock in, they clock out, they go home, they do other things. And yeah, I'm going to teach what's in this textbook, and then I'm going to go home and go fishing. I'm going to go do something else. It's not that I'm deliberately going to indoctrinate my students with things that are false.
Right.
I don't think they think that way. But also, they are inclined toward Keynesian economics because it gives them an outcome that they want. But they might not do that wittingly. It might just be they're attracted to it because it gives them that outcome. I mean, and let's face it, maybe some libertarians are attracted to Austrian economics because it implies certain things.
Well, yeah, I do have to say something on that. So you mentioned my previous work at Phi. Part of the, not to make this is the autobiography of Steve Patterson episode day, but this is relevant to what you're saying here. So I was working at Phi, and Phi would put on these conferences where they would get more Austrian sympathetic people to give talks, and you know, some of them were very good, some of them were questionable. But after the seminars were over, or you know, in the evening where the professors be hanging around, I'd be talking to them about economics. I was working through some ideas in economics, and specifically the methodology of economics, which I thought was really interesting. And the Austrians have an interesting perspective here. And at the time, I was so naive that I thought professional economists and the Austrians of all people had sorted these ideas out. I was like, oh, these got, you know, there's a long-standing debate in methodology of economics with the a priorist versus the empiricist, right? The Misesians versus the Hayekians. And I just assumed this was something that they have a few months that they sort this out. And when they were becoming professors, and I was just asking questions like, trying to learn from them. And what I realized is not only did they not have good ideas, they didn't have any ideas. I shouldn't say all of them. Okay, there were some of them that were very knowledgeable, a handful here and there, but people that I just assumed were deeply knowledgeable about their own subject matter, that were the good guys, didn't even have epistemological models here. They didn't know how they understood economic knowledge. And that sort of popped my bubble and pushed me further into the independent research camp.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's finally turn to the main reason I invited you on here. I saw an interview you did not long ago with our friend Isaac Morehouse on the subject of artificial intelligence, AI. And I asked if you would come on and talk about it. And you said that you're not an expert on it. I hate to use that language again, but this isn't your primary field, but that you are an interested layman.
Yeah.
And I thought, I do have somebody coming on. Now, of course, his name's escaping me, but he's a pretty knowledgeable guy on this stuff within the next couple of weeks. But I also want, I think there's some value in a couple of reasonably informed laymen trying to sort all this out and figure out, because even if I bring a quote expert on to tell me about AI and how it works, that expert is not necessarily trained in being able to figure out what the social or economic consequences or long-term effects on all of us are going to be. And in a way, that's more important, actually, than understanding the nuts and bolts of it. So let's start with something that I think a lot of us might have played around with already, and that is ChatGPT. Let's start right there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm very, very intrigued by and impressed with this thing, even though I understand that it is not self-aware. It can't possibly be self-aware given how it's built. But yet, what it's doing, even if sometimes its responses can be rather pedestrian, they are responses nonetheless. And even when I ask for the most unreasonable things, like, I need you to urge my daughters to clean their room, but do so in the form of a haiku, and it'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, if it has the wrong number of syllables by chance in one of the lines, if you tell it, it will apologize and fix it.
Right.
So how does this thing work?
So there's a bunch of different ways to try to create machine intelligence. The GPT, I've been looking at this stuff for many years, never been super interested in it until GPT-4 came out. And in terms of the functionality between GPT-4 and GPT-3, it's pretty substantial, where now we have a machine you can do things like reason with. And I'm like, okay, I got to figure out exactly what's going on here. But the way that the GPT machine is trained is with what's called a large language model, an LLM. And the idea is fairly simple, which is it consumes an enormous amount of text on the internet. It finds patterns in those words and sentences. And then it has a way, just through mathematics and statistics and probability, of essentially completing sentences given certain prompts based on what it has seen before. So for example, if I say, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the blank, your brain is going to go, oh, the earth, because you've heard that phrase before. You've heard that phrase a million times. Well, ChatGPT has consumed a ton of content and found patterns like that in our speech. And that's why when you talk to it, you give it a certain prompt, like you said, you know, talk to me in a haiku. Well, it has figured out what a haiku means probabilistically and can end up outputting text that we find very impressive. And one of the reasons so many people are saying this is a breakthrough, and I think it is a breakthrough, is that the large language model, like, it's a cool idea, a concept I think people can wrap their heads around. It has resulted in unexpected abilities of this machine. And even the people that were developing this, like OpenAI, did not predict the capacities that this machine would seem to display given the way that they trained it. So you could actually, you know, you can copy and paste text into it, a little paper or a blog post, and you can say, summarize this, and what are the logical weaknesses in this argument? What would somebody who totally disagrees, what would they say? And it has the ability, just with this probabilistic underpinnings, the probabilistic machinery, of being able to, in effect, reason. Now, it's not perfect, and there's a bunch of, you know, failure scenarios, and sometimes it just makes stuff up, but it's actually pretty good. It's surprisingly good at being able to follow along with arguments And again, because it's been trained on like the entire internet, it knows a bunch of information and can do really sophisticated things. So some people, I think, are running a little bit too far with this, and they think this is like totally emergent behavior. ChatGPT is sentient and that. I don't think we're at that level yet. But if you were to explain the training mechanics to somebody beforehand, pretty much anybody beforehand, including the engineers doing this, they wouldn't have predicted that you could have this much functionality with large language models.
There are so many things I want to say, because I know that it can do coding and it can do like, or AI can do a lot of things that are at a very high level. But in terms of my day-to-day life, the things that it can do in my day-to-day life are from my point of view at a very high level. So for example, I took a trip to Spain in February and I brushed up a little bit on my Spanish before going over there. And I got by pretty well. I was actually pretty pleased with it. But just for the sake of testing ChatGPT as a tool for foreign language learning, first of all, I asked it, have you been trained on languages other than English? I knew the answer had to be yes, but I wanted to know. And it said that, I think it said English is the one that it knows the best, but that it can,
yeah,
it can handle a lot of other languages. So I said, well, I took a trip to Spain and here's the situation I was in. Here's something I said. Was that correct? And then it looked at what I said, it translated it into English, and it said, yes, this is a perfectly sensible thing to say, and it makes perfect sense. However, and then in each case, it gave me extremely subtle suggestions for improvement, shades of meaning that I might want to go for instead. Or this verb is slightly more formal than the verb that is normally used in that situation. I mean, that just blew me away. And then I told it, I'm sorry, I don't yet know how to put accent marks above the letters using my keyboard. And then it said, oh, don't worry about that. I can still understand what you're saying. You feel like you're talking to a sentient being.
Yeah. And I think actually that use case is currently underrated because it has the ability to mix and match languages. So you can talk, I was just watching a thing where it was speaking, what do they call it? The mixture of Hindi and English. And like in the same prompting, you can talk to it in multiple languages because it doesn't distinguish. It doesn't think and understand like humans do. It's just been trained on a massive set of words. That massive set of words and symbols is from a ton of different languages around the world. And it's very sophisticated in its ability to effectively reason and understand what you're saying, even in multiple languages. And so I think translation is one of those where I think this is going to give us extremely high quality real-time translations that are just going to blow the old systems out of the water.
Well, another thing, you mentioned that sometimes it comes up with, or it'll make something up. And you sort of glided over that, but I do want to get into that a little bit. I'm not saying that it's worthless because it comes up with oddball responses sometimes. I just find it interesting that it comes up with the oddball responses. I mean, it's doing things that nobody could have predicted, or that I certainly couldn't have predicted even 6 months ago. So I'm not going to stand around talking about all its shortcomings as if that's the main story. I mean, for instance, I actually, for a long series of reasons, I'm planning to take a trip to Albuquerque sometime at the end of the year, of all possible things, right? So I asked, just out of curiosity, could you make me an itinerary for a 5-day visit to Albuquerque that would involve interesting sights and good restaurants? And it just, it did it instantaneously. But what I found interesting was, I think I've shared this story before, but I have a daughter who is very interested in snails. Now, I don't mean I have a 5-year-old who's interested in snails like all 5-year-olds. I mean, I have an adult daughter who is in marine biology, who's interested in snails. And so I asked it, generate a syllabus on the subject of snails, complete with recommended readings. And I bet you know what went wrong. Do you have a sense of what went wrong without my even telling you?
So there's a couple things that could go wrong here. When you're talking about a subject like snails, my guess is it's not been trained on quite enough information to be able to give you the best recommendations for books to read, for example. So that my guess is whatever it's telling you, it probably is saying, oh, well, check out this book by this person and this book by this person. And either the books don't exist or the people don't exist or some mixture of the two. That's one common failure.
No, that's it. Let me jump in. That's exactly it. The main textbook didn't exist and none of the supplementary readings existed. And so I said, I don't think there is such a book. And it said, you know, you're right. I'm sorry about that. Instead of that, why don't you read? And it recommended more things that didn't exist.
Yeah.
And I just found it interesting that for some reason, it could not say to me, I'm sorry, I don't have sufficient information to answer that question.
Right. Yeah. Well, here's the reason. So there is simply not enough information that it has been trained on the internet to change the internal models in such a way that it's going to give you accurate information. Now, I'm going to say if you do the exact same thing, but you do it about economics, which is a much more common topic. You know, if you say, tell me the top six books I have to read for understanding economics in the 20th century, it's probably going to do a good job of that because there's so much more information out there on economics versus snails. So what it's doing, this is like that's actually a great demonstration of some of the limitations of ChatGPT and why you got to be very careful when interacting with it, because it will tell you something which is totally fabricated and false, but the same confidence and writing style as it'll tell you something is accurate. Let me give you my own example. I was talking to about the philosophy of mathematics, and I was trying to pick its brain to see if it is aware of different historical examples of scientific fraud, because a lot of my research is, of course, criticizing academia. And it generated a few cases that were correct, some of which I hadn't seen before. And I looked up and I was like, wow, I'm adding this to my research list because I hadn't heard of this. And then on the philosophy of math, it was started telling me about the fraudulent, it was like a fraudulent dissertation of Alan Turing. And then it would keep going on. And I was like, hang on a second. I've never heard this. Alan Turing did some fraudulent work. And get this, I said, could you share with me the reference? Like, could you give me the link? And sometimes it doesn't share links and it has some built-in ways where it says, oh no, sorry, I can't connect to the internet. But I got it to share the source for this claim about Alan Turing. And it was a URL that went to the New York Times, but it was a fake URL. So it said www.newyorktimes.com/, and it was, you know, whatever the slug was, you know, Alan Turing fraud. But that thing didn't exist either. And if you think about it probabilistically, what it's trying to do is say, okay, the input is the user is asking for a source. What is the most likely form of a source to look like? Well, this is what a source looks like. It's a URL link to newyorktimes.com/whatever. But it's not, because it's not actually a truth machine, it's a probability machine. It just means it's a very high likelihood that this is like the form of what the truth would look like. So that's one of the, they call these hallucinations, where it'll just make up things, make up sources, make up facts, and it doesn't know any difference because it's just, it's still the same process that sometimes generates good information can create these complete fabrications.
Now, let's talk about some of the, and there's more to AI, obviously, than ChatGPT, but that's what I have some experience using. We also have seen that AI can generate images, and people have gotten a chuckle out of the problems that it seems to run into making images, but that's seems to be being overcome, that it can generate seemingly real photos of people who don't exist, or even more disturbingly, photos of people who do exist doing things they've never done, or potentially mimicking our voices and saying things we never said. And I don't see what the solution to that is.
Yeah. So in terms of ranking the risks of this technology, I think deepfakes is pretty close to the top of realistic risks here, right? I think we're going into a world in the next year or two in which scammers are going to be able to commit extremely sophisticated fraud with some of this AI technology. So an example I was talking about when I was talking about Isaac is like, imagine you got a message and it looked like an image of a loved one who was kidnapped, and you hear the voice of a loved one say, oh my gosh, this thing happened, send $10,000 to these people or something terrible is going to happen to me. And that is going to be totally compelling visually and auditorily, and it'll be fabricated. So that is terrifying in my mind. That is just one example of the mischief that's going to be caused with deepfakes. And in terms of what we do about it, I think it has to be a cultural shift. I think people are going to end up learning the hard way here that the reliability of what you see on the internet is going to go way, way, way down. And I also think this isn't just going to be for scammers. I think it'll be for nation states fabricating justification to go to war. So you could imagine, instead of the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, it could be some, look at this atrocity that was committed by the Ukrainians. Here are five different camera angles of the same atrocity. And then, you know, some nation states decide, well, now we got to go to war. and it turns out it's actually fabricated. I think that's the world we're going into. And yeah, that is very scary. We got to be prepared for that.
So then you think, well, maybe this can be mitigated a bit by having independent sources on the ground in various places around the world. But then how do we know that that independent source on the ground is real?
Yeah.
And so in a way, it could be, and this was something you hinted at in your interview with Isaac, this could be, now it just depends on whether you're a religious person or not, I suppose, but you don't have to be. In some way, this could be a kind of a gentle reminder that for all the benefits we get from going online, there is something fundamentally unreal about it as compared with real flesh and blood relationships. And maybe this helps to recall us to those types of relationships a bit more.
I think what's going to happen is there's going to be a split where you're going to have people who either been burned by this technology and say, well, forget that. I don't want to even play with that world because I can't figure out truth. I don't know which one of my relationships are real. I think you're frankly going to have quite a lot of people who are going to choose the illusion. They're going to choose to stay in the matrix, if you will. I already know, I've already had multiple people share information with me about people in their family or in their friend circle who have started to develop emotional attachments effectively to ChatGPT, where because this thing is a good conversationalist, they've opened up to it and they've got, they're developing bonds with the machine. And that may make you very uncomfortable. It makes me very uncomfortable. But you got to recognize there are some, compared to what? There are some benefits where, if somebody, there's a lot of people out there who really don't have anybody to talk to. So if they're talking to a machine about things that matter, that's kind of probably not the best precedent to set. But compared to their realistic alternatives, I wouldn't want to confidently say, this is something that nobody should do.
Yeah. And by the way, why is that inferior to sitting on a street corner talking about where you're going to get meth?
Yeah.
That's a human conversation, but that doesn't make it superior.
Right. So I really do envision we're going to be, we already live in a world in which there are people who are over-digitized, right? They're sort of, the screen has turned them into something like zombies. And I think it's just going to go further and further in that direction. And then another aspect of this is once these large language models become embodied in machines, like you have something that walks around in your house or rolls around in your house that you can talk to, that maybe you've grown up with, if you're next generation and you're 5 years old and then you're able to talk to this thing that is like taking care of you, we should expect this is going to be new territory in terms of building emotional bonds with robots. I think we're heading into that world. I have no doubt. We're kind of already in that world. I think it's just going to get magnified. And I don't know that this is a lot of thinking needs to be done here of how to try to get our hands around this technology. One approach is to take the Amish route and say, I'm going to reject it all. I think that is a valid approach, but not, I'm not going to choose that, not to reject it all, at least. So we got to figure out exactly how to get our hold on not just screen time, but also robot time and how to try to not build attachments when they're inappropriate and that kind of thing.
Everybody, a quick message from Converso. I use the Converso app for privacy because I care about privacy. And because other messaging apps that tell you they're all about privacy look like the NSA next to Converso. With Converso, you've got end-to-end encryption, no storage of messages on the server, no user or metadata. And it's not just you and me. Huge percentages of Americans are saying they're concerned with their lack of privacy and data security. They're fed up with being tracked online. They distrust big tech. They think they influence politics, you think? And they think their phone's listening in on them. They believe their texts and calls are not secure. Converso solves it all. Full of great features like sensors off, completely deactivates your phone's camera and microphone for ultimate privacy. Self-destructing messages are automatically deleted from the recipient's device after a specified time. You can prevent screenshots from being taken. It's a fantastic app. As I say, I'm already using it, and I'm going to start using it with one of my super elite private groups. So be like Woods and go over to conversoapp.com and grab it. That's conversoapp.com. You mentioned the issue of forming emotional bonds with machines. And that put me in mind of, first of all, can I presume you've watched The Twilight Zone?
Not really. I mean,
oh, really?
Okay. Here or there. Yeah.
Well, there's an interesting episode called The Lonely. And it's about a guy who, I forget why he has to be stationed on another planet, but he's all alone for at least an extended period of time. So they bring him a robot, but you can't tell it's a robot. It's in the form of a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, he indignantly rejects her. Why would I want the company of a machine? But he eventually becomes quite affectionate with her, and really, and he refuses to acknowledge that she could be anything other than a real woman. And as they finally come get him permanently, he leaves that planet. The machine slash woman gets smashed to the ground, and her head gets split open, and you can see it's all wiring and circuitry in there. And he thinks about that as he leaves. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, like, I remember watching that as a kid and thinking, what an interesting premise that is. And now, as soon as ChatGPT came out, I immediately thought, well, I've also been seeing amazing advances in robotics. You know, we see all these videos of robots walking around, leaping, doing all these crazy things with motor functions. All you have to do is put them together and, oh my gosh, you have a robot, like a real robot.
Yeah. And like you said, a lot of these technologies are advancing to make them more lifelike in terms of like skin that moves and feels like real skin, facial expressions that seem real. So that's going to be a wild new world. I really don't think that's that far away. And I had another conversation with somebody on this who was, we were trying to sort out like the ethical parts of this. Like, so if you've got somebody that has a realistic robot, let's say your neighbor has a realistic robot that has built some deep attachment to, what should the consequences be if you end up destroying that robot? Is it murder? Is it less than murder? Is it manslaughter? Is it robot slaughter? Like, you're deeply harming who the owner of the robot is. But are we prepared? Do we know exactly like how to interact with these machines, especially other people's machines? Do we have to have a new type of ethics to make sure we aren't callous and rude to robots because, in effect, they've built real relations with humans? It's a wild thing to think about.
I know. I can't believe it. When I started the Tom Woods Show, I did not realize that on episode 23, 24, we would be talking about this. So let's say a little bit. I do want to get to, again, a subject you talked about with Isaac, but unavoidable, which is isn't this going to mean that there'll be no jobs for anybody to do? I mean, we do have to kind of reckon with that. Even if there isn't a perfect answer, we have to reckon with it a little bit. But can we start to reckon with what the benefits of this might be? Because I know a lot of people, quite understandably, are hesitant about it, skeptical, maybe hostile. But what do you see as the primary benefit? Actually, you know what? Before I ask you that, I want to say something else before I forget. My friend, who he's had several podcasts over the years, Andrew Heaton, he said that for his Patreon supporters, he was going to do an episode of his show that was going to be in his voice, but scripted and done by AI, just to say, and I didn't listen to it. But of course, it made me think, if AI got to a point where it could get a sense of how I speak and what my mannerisms are, it could start generating episodes of the Tom Woods Show, presumably. And the question would be, would people like to listen to the Tom Woods Show created by AI more than they would like to listen to the real Tom Woods? Because the real Tom Woods is going to stumble over his words from time to time. He'll make mistakes once in a while, whereas AI Tom Woods doesn't have those shortcomings. But I have this sense that I nevertheless, like, I don't want to listen to AI Steve Patterson. I want Steve Patterson. And this is not a perfect analogy, but for some reason I can't help thinking about it. Suppose we lived in a world where you could either buy life insurance for your family, or you could take a pill that would make you think you had bought it. And in each case, you would have the happiness and satisfaction of knowing your loved ones would be cared for. And the pill would be much cheaper than actually buying them the life insurance. And you would feel exactly the same way. Nobody would take the pill. Even if it would give them exactly the same outcome, nobody would take that pill. We all want to get real life insurance for our family. So I kind of feel like there's a way in which that's analogous to, I want the real Steve Patterson. I want the real Tom Woods. I still feel like there are human qualities that we will always want on some level. So in fact, you know what? Forget what I said about benefits. We'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
Let's get right into the dangers, that there could be an AI Tom Woods Show. What do you agree with me that people would rather have the flesh and blood Steve Patterson than the AI Steve Patterson?
Well, when I look at myself in the mirror, I go, give me the flesh and blood all the way. That is one handsome person. No, I think it depends. I think the honest answer is it's going to depend. I did want to correct one thing, though. You said the AI is not going to have your same speech idiosyncrasies. That's not correct. So they've already done compelling deepfakes, video and audio, of different celebrities and public figures. And the AI actually tracks those speech patterns as well. There's one I just watched the other day of Sam Altman, who's the CEO of OpenAI. And it was totally fabricated script. His voice was totally fabricated. And the AI mimicked his tendency to say, at just the right places and just the right cadence. So even some of those subtle things are going to be, I think, able to be mimicked by the machine. But in terms of what people would prefer, I just think it's going to be a mix. Some people are going to want the human connection behind podcasting. Some people are just going to want the information. And in some cases, the quality of information, I think, could be higher when you're talking AI outputs than human outputs. Now, that being said, I do think pluralism is the correct prediction here that you're going to have. For example, if I'm trying to go to YouTube and figure out, and I'm looking at a how-to video for how to do some plumbing thing. And, you know, it's like, okay, I've got a drip and how do I fix the drip? I don't actually care if it's AI generated. In fact, I think I would prefer it be AI generated because the quality of information is probably going to be higher and it can cut straight to the chase. I don't care if the sink is a real sink or if the hand that's holding the wrench is a real hand. I just want the information. But that's going to be different than my preferences when I listen to the Tom Woods Show. I'm not going to want the AI to try to generate this content. I'm interested in the people and the real conversations, the live conversations and meetings of real minds. So I think it's going to be a mix.
So as long as we're on this, there's obviously a lot of disruption that is going to happen as a result of this. And I know there have been efforts, petitions to try to halt the development of the technology or delay it or this or that, or some people even just want to abolish it altogether. But I don't see that that's plausible. These are the cards we've been dealt. We have to decide how we're going to play those cards. And this is going to be disruptive in the sense that, you know, it's almost become a cliche now, but everybody thought that it would be the blue collar workers who are doing the repetitive jobs in some cases that would be, you know, like truck drivers that would find themselves displaced by technology. But if this technology can draw up legal documents and do all kinds of other things, then it's coming for the white collar people too. How do we prepare for that? Or is this a bad thing, a good thing? How do you assess it?
Well, I think it's a mix. In the long run, I think it's a very good thing. It could be a real breakthrough in terms of bringing the costs of goods and services down anywhere from an order of magnitude to 5-6 orders of magnitude. An example I like to give is the production of movies and films and documentaries. Like, I would love to be able to produce documentaries on some of the stuff I've researched. But it's expensive, it's time consuming, it takes expertise, you got to pay the right people, you got to have actors and whatever. In the next couple of years, there's going to be technology that is going to allow me to generate fake people saying things that I want them to say. I'm going to be able to fake films and videos from different angles that I'm going to be able to totally customize exactly how I want. And that's just for documentaries, but if you want to be, you know, a Hollywood producer, you're going to bring your cost of production from literally millions of dollars down to a few $100 or less than that, depending on how much computation you need. So the gains in productivity could be in specific domains extremely high. And I'm very optimistic about that. And like with lawyers, you brought up lawyers as a great example. Not only are they going to be able to write up legal documents for you, they're also going to be able to tell you facts about the law that you would otherwise have to pay $1,000, $2,000 an hour to hear from a lawyer. I believe ChatGPT-4 passed the bar exam, if I'm not mistaken. And so you can actually get, it's like, wouldn't that be a tragedy, Tom, if we saw a world in which so many lawyers were put out of business? Honestly, I don't think I'm going to lose too much sleep over that, especially when the gains are going to be massive. So again, but I think it's a mix, right? It's going to be very disruptive to certain domains. And I'm going to have to appeal to the free market economics that I'm persuaded by and say, you know, these are difficult growing pains, but the important part is being able to adjust in a market and have labor reallocated to places it needs to be reallocated to, even if that's very painful. And honestly, I really do think there might be a growing movement of people who want to roll back the clock and they don't want to incorporate this technology in their lives. They want to live, let's say, more like the Amish or on that spectrum. They want to be employed doing things that are not just for the economic perks, but they want to be part of a village. And I think, you know, that's fine. I think that's one potential way to not have a complete revolution in terms of our what our economy looks like, is to say, okay, we're just not going to, our group is going to live in a small village. We're not going to be high tech. And we're going to try to bring it back to, I don't know, the 1980s or the 1880s and just be happy with that lifestyle, which I think is a, I think that's a valid choice as well.
One way I try to help people think about things like this would be, let's say we're back to the self-driving cars and self-driving trucks issue. Mm-hmm. And people like Tucker Carlson, for example, whom I like very much, but he says he would never allow self-driving trucks on the road because of all the truckers who would lose their jobs. And you're right, that would be very painful for a lot of people because they organize their lives around the expectation that they could make a good living as a truck driver. But what I say is, suppose we lived in an alternate universe in which you were born into a world in which goods could be instantaneously transported simply by thinking about it.
Yeah.
And no trucks were necessary. Would you go around saying, I hate this world I've been born into because now no one will be able to drive a truck for a living?
Right.
This would just be a background feature of the world you live in, and you wouldn't try to spend your life defying it or figuring out ways to frustrate it. You would just accommodate yourself to it. Okay, then I guess if we don't need people doing that, we always need them doing something. There's always something people are going to be needed for.
Right. Yeah, I like that argument. Though I would say something I found myself, a trap I found myself falling into when having these types of discussions, not just about AI, but about technological disruption generally, is that we libertarians tend to say, well, in a free market, labor will adjust, capital will adjust. That's a good thing in the big picture. But what it tends to overlook, but certainly has in my case, is that those transition periods can be terribly painful. And because the government already has a bunch of silly labor regulations, you already have a minimum wage, for example, you already have a boot on the neck of entrepreneurs, the adjustment that we would expect to happen in a market is going to be really hard and slow and maybe non-existent for a lot of people, right? So when the mining jobs leave in West Virginia, it's one thing to say, okay, well, that's the market adjusting and like people will find new employment. But the fact of the matter is, because we don't really have a free functioning market, people's lives are going to be disrupted, damaged, families are going to be destroyed, and there's not going to be a clear new employment opportunity that will present itself to everybody who loses their job. So I'm not saying this is the mistake that you're making. I'm just saying when I think about this, I know I have made that mistake before and sort of trivializing the pain that people are going to feel when they lose their jobs due to technological adjustment.
Right. Now, my father was a forklift operator. And of course, if that was completely automated, then yeah, it would have been difficult for him to figure out what to do. Now, so that was an interesting case of, on the one hand, the existence of the forklift, that level of technology was very much a boon to him.
Yeah.
Because he was able to be way more productive than he could have been with his bare hands. But then if the forklift basically does the work, then sure. Yeah, that is, I'm just thinking in terms of society-wide, it's not like it's an unsolvable problem in the long run.
Right.
But in the short run, you're right. Yeah, there are, and especially given that the state has made the adjustment all the more excruciating, then this is a problem. But there's also, I've talked to one of my daughters who is, she's not going to be an artist for a living, but she's artistically inclined. And she was curious about what the rise of AI-powered art means for graphic designers, let's say, and what the ethics of it are. Now, I realize intellectual property is another matter. We could get sidetracked on that. But her point was that given that AI is sort of known for not, one of its weaknesses is it can't envision brand new original things, brand new bold ideas, but it's really, really good at digesting the existing ones, that basically it's taking other people's hard work and synthesizing it into something else. And she's wondering about that.
Yeah.
And of course, this will mean that graphic designers will be in quite a spot. I don't know. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard one in terms of ethics. Ethics is also, in my opinion, like the hardest domain of philosophy. But I tend to think that it's not ultimately an ethical violation unless there's been some breach of contract somewhere. Like, I don't know if people are doing this now or they're talking about it where they want a way to be able to mark that their content is not available to be digested by the AI. And I think that's an interesting idea. I don't know if it would work. Maybe there's a way to watermark your stuff where that could work. I'm not sure. But But I think it's an interesting idea trying to solve that problem in terms of contracts. But in the grand scheme of things, I think it will be an enormous boon for human creativity for anybody to be able to generate really engaging images and video and architecture by interacting with the AI. Like one of the examples I like to talk about is architecture in particular. Like if you imagine, so we have certain expectations about how buildings are supposed to look and the relation with their functionality. But imagine you had the super advanced computer program that you could go in and you could literally like speak different parts of your digital house into existence. So you could say, like you're an architectural designer and you're like, okay, I want an arch here and over here, this is going to be a dome and there's going to be a water fountain in the middle of this place. And like, let's say you're in VR and you're speaking aloud and you're able to manipulate that digital environment with your speech. And then at the end of it, you can say, now, is this building going to fall down or not? Is this building going to meet the code regulations or not? And it'll say, yeah, this is architecturally sound or whatever. And then you can say, okay, order all the materials, have them shipped to this location, and the whole thing is automated. And suddenly, just by using your speech, you can, in practice, be an architect. That is sort of an example where the machine is stealing a whole bunch of knowledge from architects and professionals who've been, you know, working on this stuff for thousands of years. It's consuming their books and stealing work from the physicists. And yet the ultimate result is that you're going to be able to, you know, create what is going to look like brand new architecture from scratch through natural language. I just can't not get excited about that. And I can't, like the same with the videos and audio and images. I'm like, I think the pros outweigh the cons there.
I haven't used anything other than ChatGPT, nothing else. Have you?
Yeah. So there are different AI systems that are focused more on images. There's something called Midjourney, which is one that I've been using. But in terms of the large language models, there are a few other models out there, some of which are much smaller, which is very exciting. Like people are going to try to get the functionality of these large language models on your smartphone, like where you could have a personal one and not have to communicate to Google. It's just mind blowing. I haven't personally used those yet, just GPT for the text models.
So for me, as I say, my experience with it is limited. But, you know, I'm sure you read the warnings about AI and where it could go. And I guess, given that my understanding of it is extremely limited, I don't really know how to evaluate the warnings of what the problems could be. And the warnings from some people go well beyond this will displace some workers. I mean, there really are people saying that you could have an extinction level event. Now, that I think is probably a bit of an exaggeration. But at this point, given the way you described how ChatGPT works, that it's basically a matter of a vast, vast amount of data being fed to it to train it, and then it uses that to predict, in effect, what word needs to go where, That doesn't sound to me like anything that's going to take over the world, literally. So what directions is the technology going in that would make somebody think that there could be problems?
Well, so I'm the wrong person to ask this question to, because I have strong feelings here, where I actually think there's a group of people, the doomsdayers, that I think are causing a lot more harm than good, because they want the discussion to be about existential risk. I mean, you know, they want the discussion to be, well, you know, the most prominent person here has publicly claimed there's a 99.9% chance of human extinction on the horizon. So like, you know, tie up your loose ends with your family. Now we're all going to die. And unfortunately, in my opinion, this person has a lot of people listening to him. So I think it's kind of a framing error to start from that standpoint. But I will try to give a summarized argument, which is, so there's a difference between AI and superintelligence. They have this concept of superintelligence, that machine is going to get so sophisticated that it's going to figure out how to improve its own level of intelligence. So it's going to be rewriting its own code. And then essentially, it's going to give itself, you know, over, it just keep iterating with a high level of intelligence that is able to make itself smarter and smarter and smarter. It's going to get more and more and more power. And then when it is trying to accomplish particular goals, it might, in its cold machine heart, just decide, in order to accomplish these particular goals, I need to wipe out humanity. Or I need to, one of the examples they give is like, they have this concern, if you give a super intelligent machine the instruction to create as many paperclips as you can. But if it's super intelligent and it's mastered the secrets of the universe, then it's going to end up converting your house into a paperclip. And then it's going to see that you, right now, your human body is made up of carbon molecules or whatever. So it vaporizes you and it turns your molecules and organizes them into a paperclip. And eventually everything, you know, is going to be turned into one gigantic paperclip. To illustrate the concept of superintelligence killing everybody, I just really don't like that idea. And I think it takes away from like the real genuine concerns here, not just about deepfakes, but also killer robots and drones. We already live in a world where there are drones, but imagine you have fields of drones that are all able to be highly coordinated by artificial intelligence. Well, that's a real risk. That's not an existential risk. That's in the same category as like nuclear weapons are a real risk. We need to talk about them and take them seriously, but it's not like, you know, the genie gets out of the bottle or the demon is summoned and he kills us all. It's like, well, the problem is still humans using extremely powerful technology for their own nefarious ends, in my book.
What do we say? This we'll try to wrap up here, but I've had some people express privacy concerns. They think that the AI platforms are either absorbing a lot of your information or you're voluntarily feeding it things. And by feeding it to them, maybe it can help them develop a kind of profile of who you are, and that this could have dangerous consequences. Do you have any thoughts there?
Well, I think that's in the category of deep fakes. That's going to be a big, I mean, it already has models out there. I'm sure that a bunch of people's information, if they're prominent, there's enough of it out there where it'll be able to pretend to be you in messages. And then, you know, it might be able to create, if you give it instructions to create a fake social media account and use your picture. Like, I think all of that stuff is possible. In terms of privacy generally, yeah, I think it's definitely going to have a model of people. But that's not my first concern, is privacy. There's actually some interesting possibility here, which is if we get instead of there being one AI, if we get a situation where there are like thousands and thousands or millions of little AIs, either that you have on your smartphones or on your computer, you run on your actual like local laptop, you have your own personal AI, it may be that there is some kind of privacy gain there because you're not connecting to the one Google server to interact with these AIs. So right now, the trajectory is that we're going to have a lot of AIs and not one big one. So I could actually see that be a net boon for privacy, where you get a lot of the benefits of the AI without having to connect to Google at all. And in fact, you might not even have to connect to the internet. In terms of safety and security of this technology, I would not recommend plugging every part of your life into the internet generally. That seems like a bad way to be safe from the dangers of the internet. But also, if we have a situation where you have household AIs and maybe multiple of them, and they're super highly functional and you can speak to them in natural language and they know what you're saying and they can do the things you ask them to do, you might not even have to plug them into the internet at all. So not only is that a, you know, a security improvement, it's also a privacy improvement. You know, you might be able to have your conversations with the AI and then that information never leaves the AI to go back out to the web. I think that's also a possibility that I'm optimistic about.
Steve, how do people follow you? You have a Substack. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/2324. Is that the main outlet?
So I've been producing stuff, yeah, recently on Substack. I also have a website, steve-patterson.com. And if anybody's interested in getting notified about my research institute, it's called the Natural Philosophy Institute, and they can join the wait list at nathi.org, natphi.org. And I'm hoping later this year that'll be launched.
Okay, I'm going to link to everything you just said at tomwoods.com/2324. Well, as I suspected, it was a good conversation. It was interesting. I enjoyed getting your thoughts. I know there will be some super duper tech people who will tut-tut us about this or that problem, but I think we're looking at big picture questions here about something that has taken almost everybody by surprise. And I'm really, really glad we decided to do this. So thanks very much, Steve.
Yes, thanks for having me on. It was great talking with you.
All right, folks, a couple of things before we wrap up. It's going to be a short week this week on the Tom Wood Show, just the three episodes, although this was a pretty long and juicy one. But I've been on the road and I've got the supporters party coming up this weekend. So you can always dig back into the archive of 2,323 other episodes you may not have heard while you await the episodes for next week. I'll have Corey DeAngelis back on the show. because he has a brand new book. So that's coming up next week. But I do want to make mention of, I just glided over the fact that I'm having a supporters party this weekend. If you support the Tom Woods Show, I throw a couple of parties every year in addition to the 817 other benefits you get. And that's coming right up this coming Saturday, which is April 29th, 2023. So if you'd like to be on the invitation list for one of those parties, you've got to be a supporter of the Tom Woods Show. And you can do that at supportinglisteners.com and come and socialize with normal people and hang around with me and get free food, free in quotation marks, but free-ish food. You do have to be a supporter to get it, but depending on your support level, you could still come out ahead the way I look at it. Anyway, check that out at supportinglisteners.com. Lots of great benefits you get over there. And the second thing, I think the first thing was it's going to be a short week. So we're all finished. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.